I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. This Sunday, we mark the 50th anniversary of the Canadian flag, a book that's been re-released in celebration of this milestone. It's a remarkable book, A Flag for Canada. It's from the publisher Stanton, Atkins, and Dossal, who we've come to know for marvelous books featuring gorgeous photography, ephemera, art, and posters. The book's author, Rick Archbold, joins me now, and we'll talk about his biography of the maple leaf symbol that was first raised on Parliament Hill on the 15th of February, 1965. The red and white flag has become unmistakable with being Canadian, and we see in Mr. Archbold's book how quickly that happened, but it's also interesting for the backstory of what we used for a flag from colonial times to the fierce debate that ensued when Lester Pearson first broached the idea of a new standard for Canada. I'll get Mr. Archbold to tell us about the opposition Pearson had from John Diefenbaker and what Mr. Diefenbaker thought of the maple leaf. Rick Archbold is a Toronto-based writer and editor whose work reflects his fascination with Canadian politics and history. He edited the museum called Canada and wrote The Discovery of the Titanic with Robert Ballard and Robert Bateman's Natural World and Conversations with Mummies with Rosalie David. He's edited books by Eugene Whalen, Audrey McLaughlin, John Sawatsky, and Kim Campbell. Visit flagforcanada.ca for more. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Rick Archbold. Mr. Archbold, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I've been a big fan of this book, Flag for Canada, and then I guess the first iteration of it was called I Stand for Canada, the story
Correct.
Of the Maple Leaf Flag, for a number of years now. How did this book come about? I mean, this is about, what, 10 years or more now?
Yes, and I think the original edition was 2002 and the revised edition in 2008. It was very much, I think, a labor of love on the part of the publishers. The three names that you mentioned, Roberto Dossal, is actually the designer of the book as well. And he is, I believe, originally from Argentina. And he tells the story of how when he stepped off the plane from Argentina, when he came to Canada for the first time, he saw the flag and just went, what a beautiful flag. And after having lived in Canada for a few years, it became apparent to him that nobody had properly celebrated the story of how the flag came to be. So that's really how the book was generated, and I, with my interest in history, turned out to be a good person to actually write the text.
It seems like it was fun to do, was it?
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Well, I'm old enough to remember the flag debate, and I was very involved as a teenager in politics and what was going on at the time. So this was just a natural thing for me. I found it fascinating. It turned out to be an interesting way of actually looking at the story of the whole history of the country in terms of this one symbol.
The flag was first raised 50 years ago, and I guess the debate over whether this country should have its own flag was a few years before that. Was it really Pearson's idea to come up with a new flag for Canada?
Actually, people had been trying to do this for quite a while. I think the first official attempt was in the 1920s under Mackenzie King. And again in 1945, after World War II, Mackenzie King actually struck a parliamentary committee which had hearings, looked at potential designs, and actually came up with a design which was then quietly buried by Mackenzie King, who decided that it was just too hot to handle. But Pearson is definitely the person who led the charge to finally break this impasse and give us a flag in time for our centennial year.
So coming up to 1967, that was the real impetus for it, right?
I think that was one of the impulses. But if you sort of look at Pearson and his career as an international diplomat and then becoming prime minister, he would have been very conscious of how Canada was seen outside, around the world. In fact, there's a great story which we tell in the book from the time of the Suez Crisis in 1956, when Pearson helped broker the ceasefire and came up with the idea for the first peacekeeping force. And the problem was that when President of Egypt, Abdel Nasser, looked at the Canadian flag, what he saw was a British flag, and he told Pearson, in as many words, "I don't want any Canadians on your peacekeeping force," which was kind of ironic. Mm. And I don't think Pearson forgot that. But the actual, really the deep reason for promoting a flag when he did was that the country was in a kind of a volatile state, I think. And while the centennial was looming, but more importantly, we didn't have a unifying symbol. The old flag, the Red Ensign, which many of us remember, the Canadian Red Ensign, was a flag that divided people. It didn't bring them together. And it seems he was smart enough to realize that the country was changing, that it was no longer just the outgrowth of Britain and France, but a far more diverse country than that, and that nothing would really do except a flag that was Canadian, not British or French.
Did we use the Red Ensign from Confederation on?
The evidence I've got is that Sir John A. Macdonald started flying a Red Ensign from the Victoria Tower or whatever it was on the old Parliament buildings, from about 1868 on until the Boer War, interestingly enough, when they put the Union Jack back up because they were feeling very British at that point. But so there's a long history of the Red Ensign, even before Confederation, being flown by Canadians as, lacking anything better, this is our flag.
And there was no talk at Confederation in Charlottetown that as we're putting this country together, we should have a flag?
No, because we didn't think of ourselves as a full-fledged country, I guess. Hmm. We still saw ourselves as kind of half a colony. I mean, remember, it used to be the Dominion of Canada, mm-hmm. not simply Canada. And there was no talk, as far as I know, of a flag, which is interesting, actually.
Yeah. And so the flag that Pearson wanted is a lot different than the flag that we have today. Yeah. And so what was the process in terms of how we came to the flag that we have today, the maple leaf and then the two red bars on either side?
Well, we started with Pearson's pennant, as Stephen Baker mm-hmm. disparagingly referred to it. And that was a quite pretty little flag with two blue bars and three maple leaves in the middle. And this is what Pearson actually proposed to Parliament on June 15th, 1964. Of course, it being Pearson's flag, his arch rival and opponent, John Diefenbaker, was going to have nothing of it. Besides, Diefenbaker was a Red Ensign man. He mm-hmm. was a believer in the old symbols of the old countries. So from the start, it appeared there was a complete impasse between the Liberal government and the official opposition, which was the Tories. And the debate actually dragged on through the summer. I believe they went completely through the summer without a recess into September, and people were still giving the same speeches back and forth at each other, to the point where finally Pearson and the other party leaders agreed, we've got to do something. So they struck a committee and handed the problem to a committee. And, in true Canadian fashion, our flag was designed by a committee.
And then we all know of the Heritage Minute, which features John Matheson.
Yes, indeed.
Who was
one of the key members of the committee and had kind of been Pearson's right-hand man on the flag file from the beginning.
So were these designs, were they elicited from the public?
There was no formal request for people to send things in, but it seems people just decided that they were going to send in designs because thousands came in, I think something like 3,500 when all was said and done, many of which, if you've ever seen a picture of the flag committee, there's one in the book of the flag committee room, it is festooned top, bottom, side with flags of every shape and description. It's really a wonderful photograph, and it shows you that the committee had no dearth of options to choose from.
And so, Mr. Matheson, in his role in all of this, because there's also another figure who you write about in the book, who's from this part of the world, who a lot of us in Vancouver know of for his work with regards to Expo 86, Patrick Reed.
Yes.
How does he come into the story and the design of the flag that we have today?
Well, Patrick Reed was head of, I believe it was called the Museum, National Museums Commission. And this organization of the federal government was responsible for designing government publications and museum displays, and I believe was already gearing up for the centennial. And what Matheson did was turn the basic flag as it came out of the committee, which was the two red bars and a red maple leaf in the middle, and said, make it look as good as possible. And that's what Patrick Reed and his designer, who is a gentleman by the name of Jacques Saint-Cyr, that's what they did. And there's a wonderful story of Matheson and Patrick Reed and Saint-Cyr standing in a hallway at the National Museums Commission holding up flags and saying, no, it's a little bit too busy at the base, until they finally came up, Saint-Cyr came up with this wonderful 11-point version of the sugar maple leaf, which actually has, I think, 23 points on it. And yet there's no question when you see the flag that it's a sugar maple leaf. So it's a brilliant simplification of actually quite a complicated natural phenomenon.
Well, what about the myth that the flag, because it's in red, is a symbol of the Liberal Party of Canada?
Well, that is utter nonsense.
Where did that start? Was that from Mr. Diefenbaker?
Of course. It started after the flag was adopted, and it was by the people who were disgruntled because they'd lost the fight, I guess. But the simple answer is the official colors of Canada are red and white. They were granted by George V in 1921, and they are featured on the Canadian coat of arms, which was also granted at that time. And anybody who knew anything about the sort of heraldic history of Canada would have known that, and it was a point that was, I think, made a number of times by various people who are in favor of the new flag. But Diefenbaker wasn't interested in that particular piece of history.
It was
a British piece.
Yeah, he was always rather selective, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Rick, in the course of writing this book, did you go to Hansard and read, say, the debates over the flag in the House?
I will confess I did not read the entire 6 months of debates. I read the opening speeches on June 15th when Diefenbaker gave a wonderful opening speech.
Right.
Skewering Pearson, who also gave a wonderful speech.
Yeah.
It makes you regret and feel nostalgic for the days when people actually spoke complete sentences.
Man, yeah.
And could actually conjure up images and so on. I did read some of the debate leading up to the final adoption. This is, now we're talking December 1964, when the Tories filibustered, and it looked like the compromise flag, the one that we've ended up with, was also going to die on the order paper until one of Diefenbaker's own lieutenants, his Quebec lieutenant, Léon Balsay, stood up in the House of Commons and actually asked the Prime Minister to invoke cloture, which is to force a way of forcing a vote. That was the point at which Diefenbaker's, you know, opposition collapsed. And in fact, I think probably was one of the last nails in his coffin as leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
As a flag, compared to other ones, it is a well-designed flag. I mean, it's a very robust design, isn't it? I mean, it's simple, but yet it means so much.
It's simple, it's meaningful, and it is intelligible from a great distance.
Mm.
There's no question that's the Canadian flag. It's not the flag of Peru, as Diefenbaker disparagingly said at one point. It's absolutely without a doubt, and I think a large part of its success was its instant success, really, because once the flag was adopted, there was very little fuss about it being, you know, becoming widespread. It's because it was so instantly recognizable. When I was a 19-year-old in 1969, I went hitchhiking through Europe, as many people did in those days, and the first thing I did was sew a Canadian flag on my backpack.
Huh. And so that was very quick, wasn't it? I mean, we recognized, you know.
It seemed almost instantaneous.
Yeah.
I don't remember there being any fuss afterwards. There obviously were people who grumbled.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that Ontario and Manitoba both adopted red ensigns immediately afterwards as their provincial flags, as if to say, well, you may like the maple leaf, but we still want the old flag. But beyond those kind of failed symbolic gestures, there is very little opposition that I'm aware of. It's more a story of going from success to success. I mean, the maple leaf, as designed by Jacques Saint-Cyr, got picked up by all sorts of organizations and incorporated into their logos, and you know, you could say that the maple leaf flag became Canada's brand almost.
Yeah. And you have in the book ephemera, as I mentioned in, off
yes.
the top. There are labels for products and the sort that go
yes.
back even before the 1960s, where the maple leaf really symbolizes Canada, right?
Well, the maple leaf. One of the interesting things about doing the book, as we call it a biography of the maple leaf symbol, is how far back in history the maple leaf goes as something that simply meant Canadian. The earliest documented example is actually, ironically, the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Society. In Quebec, in 1836, the president of the society, speaking to his annual convention, said, "The maple is the king of our forests. The maple leaf is the emblem of the Canadian people." That's 1836. And what happened in the years following is that it was picked up in English Canada, and in 1860, when the future Edward VII came on a royal visit, every native-born Canadian in Ontario wore a maple leaf to indicate that he was a native-born Canadian. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
But the real moment, I think, when the maple leaf became, sort of grew up and became the potential flag of Canada, was in World War I, when it was worn as a part of the cap and collar badges that the servicemen wore into battle, and when Canadians were known as Maple Leaves, that was their nickname.
Yeah.
So Canadian soldiers, in fact, there's a wonderful poem that I think I can quote the final stanza of that appeared in the Toronto Globe in maybe 1916, in which exemplifies this, what had happened to the Maple Leaf over the previous 50 years or so. It goes like this: "The maple leaves were heroes all. They rose at duty's clarion call. Grimly they held the wavering line, pouring out precious blood like wine. Now victory weaves immortal wreaths of red, red leaves." You couldn't have asked for a better leaf promotion. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And that was 1916. So by the time Pearson is proposing the flag, he knows that it has a whole lot of history behind it. It's not just a pretty leaf.
One of the great stories that you recount in the book is what happened at Mr. Diefenbaker's funeral. You mentioned that he's a red ensign man through and through, but I guess if you are entitled to a state funeral in this country, you have to have the maple leaf, I guess, on one's casket. And so how do you get around that?
Well, Diefenbaker really got the last laugh in this case, because if you look at the photographs of his state funeral,
mm-hmm.
yes, the casket is beautifully draped with the red and white maple leaf flag, and over top of the maple leaf flag is a red ensign. So good old Dief, somehow he managed to specify in his instructions that the old flag, the one that he cared for, was going to trump the new Canadian flag, even in death. He never gave up.
There has been some mystery over the Canadian flag and I guess the first flag that flew on Parliament Hill.
It seems to have disappeared. I mean, various times people have come forward and said, "This is the first flag,"
mm-hmm.
and then it turns out, oh no, it was the first flag flown from the Peace Tower. It's the first flag flown someplace else, or we can't really prove it at all. Who knows? Someone has it. Whether it is of any real intrinsic historic value, of course, is another question. More interesting to me are the prototype flags that were silkscreened at Patrick Reed's National Museums Commission, mm-hmm. and then shown to Pearson before the actual final design was unveiled. And there were originally, according to Reed, three of them, but only one has come to light. And this is a beautiful silkscreen piece of really cheesecloth. It's a very lightweight cloth, which has exactly the flag we know today, with one tiny exception. The bottom of the stem is cut on a bias.
Mm.
And, of course, the reason they changed that is because it would have shown through on the other side,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to have it match perfectly. But it's just a beautiful piece of history.
To digress here for just a sec here, in reading up on you and finding out about your career as a writer, as an editor, I understand that you edited Kim Campbell's memoir. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
I've interviewed people who've edited other prime ministers' memoirs in the past, so you'll indulge me for a sec for a question
Absolutely.
Or two on that.
It's one of my favorite topics.
Yeah. So what's that process like when you as an editor are given, say, a former prime minister's memoirs? And I remember I have a copy of the book here at the house, and I looked at the acknowledgments page last night, and she talks about the process that she endured with you.
Mm-hmm.
In editing that, so how did you approach?
Well, in the case of Kim Campbell, first of all, she actually wrote her own memoirs,
mm-hmm.
which many politicians do not. Many
right.
politicians talk into a tape recorder, and I've done that. I ghost wrote Eugene Whalen's memoirs and Audrey McLaughlin's memoirs, but she wrote her own book, but consulted me as she was writing. So it wasn't that she handed me a manuscript at the end of the day and said, here, edit it. She actually listened to my advice on, you know, in this chapter I think you should structure it this way, how about this? It was actually quite a good experience as these things go, and I think that the final result was half-decent.
Yeah.
It's a very tricky thing writing memoirs, getting the writer to tell as much as the reader wants to know, specifically personal stuff that is not that comfortable. And as you may recall, Kim came from a very difficult family situation as a young woman, and she just didn't want to write about that at all. And I said to her, but you have to, because that otherwise people will think you're hiding something. And ultimately, she agreed and did put enough in the book that you know, a reader could say, okay, I understand where she's coming from.
So she lost the election in the fall of 93.
Yes.
How soon after that did she start this process, and
she,
when did you come into it?
I would have come in fairly early.
Because the book came out in 96, is that right?
Yeah, I actually don't remember precisely when I became
yeah.
involved, but if it came out in 96, it means that we probably started in 94.
And so, and not just about her, but I mean, she's a figure of history, and
yes.
you have written books with other politicians. When they write their memoirs, how much of what they're writing is, say, trying to redeem themselves in history?
Well, I think for sure everybody is going to be inclined to paint the rosiest possible picture of themselves. But the good ones, like Whalen, they just tell the stories and kind of let the facts as they remember them. And, of course, we remember things selectively. So the story that any one of these people tells is a story that tends to make me look good rather than bad. But I think within what they select, they tend to be pretty honest about what went on. It's just that sometimes things that we'd really rather not talk about, they just don't remember them
and
conveniently.
Yeah, and so the memoir on Campbell, I remember reading that when that first came out, and you know, it was in high school then. But I mean, I remember it, and I remember how candid she was.
Yes, yeah, she was very candid in stating her positions and in talking about her past. But it was primarily a memoir about her time in politics.
Yeah.
And very focused on issues and debates of the time.
And she was quite honest about that campaign in 93.
Yes.
And absolutely. The people around her at the time, right? People like the Camp, David Camp, and John Tory, even.
I was going to say, you know, people forget that her campaign manager was John Tory. Until recently, I used to say about John Tory, he'd never met an election he couldn't lose.
Rick, you're involved with another famous book in Canadian political history, the biography by John Sawatsky of Brian Mulroney. You edited that, and you even won awards for it, did you not?
Yes, I actually got, there's an editing award called the Tom Fairley Award that I won for editing that book. It was a very interesting project and probably one of the most demanding editing jobs I've ever encountered.
And a lot of people remember Sawatsky from this part of the world because he worked at the Vancouver Sun.
That's right.
And then he went on to the Ottawa Citizen, I think, and he's now, I guess, at ESPN training everyone
everyone in the world on how to be an investigative journalist.
How to be a great interviewer, too, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That book, when that came out, that sold well.
It wasn't, very well.
Yeah, it wasn't terribly popular with Mr. Mulroney, as I recall.
It wouldn't have been because it didn't present him in a terribly flattering light. But, of course, John is extremely thorough, and nothing went into that book that wasn't a fact that he could document. So the art with someone like John, who doesn't even pretend to be a highfalutin writer type, you know, but someone who simply presents the facts as he discovers them, he worked with me, allowed me to kind of take his prose. He's not jealous of it, as some writers are, and massage it into, you know, to read even better than it did when it started out. And it was quite an interesting job.
I turned my head here as I'm talking to you to the bookshelf that's just off to my right here, and I see a number of books on Mulroney. That's probably one of the better ones, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I also had a little bit of a hand in another book, Stevie Cameron's book, On the Take,
mm-hmm.
Which is a far more controversial, I think, and probably hated by Mulroney even more.
Right. That book, I mean, I've talked to her about that, and she says that she's never been sued for it, so...
So she must have done something right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't think we were ever sued for John's book, so he did his work.
Yeah. As I said, the books do stand up, don't they?
They really do.
Yeah. What will you be thinking about on Sunday as we mark the 50th anniversary of the flag, Rick?
Well, I think what where my mind goes is to the history, and not so much to the great broils of the 1960s, but to the history of how this, you know, innocent little leaf grew over time to have the symbolic weight that could support its use on a flag. I like to say that when people ask me who designed the Canadian flag, I always laugh and say, well, many people have volunteered for that title, but in fact, it was designed by the Canadian people. It was designed by the Canadian people over a century and a half, making the kinds of decisions that those people did in 1860 when they wore a silver pin to see Edward VII, until it reached the point where really, when the committee was deliberating, if once they'd tossed out the red ensign and flags with the old symbols on it, they really didn't have much choice than come up with a very simple maple leaf flag, which they did.
Do you wonder why we're not there's no big celebration on Sunday?
Yeah, I've wondered why, and I think I know why.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad to say that this government has managed to turn the symbol of national unity into a partisan topic, but given that they spend as much as spent as much as they've spent on Sir John A. Macdonald and the War of 1812, which is of little interest outside of Ontario and Quebec. I think they spent $4 million on Sir John A. alone. And they've set aside $50,000 for the anniversary of the Maple Leaf flag. What it tells you is that they're essentially ignoring it. And the only conclusion that you can draw from that is they're ignoring it because it was an accomplishment of a Liberal government 50 years ago. One would have hoped that we could have risen above partisan considerations by now. It's a kind of a sad commentary on the state of politics today.
Rick, this is this book of yours, A Flag for Canada, and before that, I Stand for Canada, are just marvelous books, and there really are a great service to this country. Thanks for your time today. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you about the flag and other things, obviously.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
It's a terrific book. There's some great photographs, some terrific art and ephemera, and the story of our flag. It's an important book to have, so do pick it up. Flagforcanada.ca is the website for more. The book is called A Flag for Canada. It's published by Stanton, Atkins, and Dossal. Its author, Rick Archibald, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.